y'all. Welcome back to But Not All at Once, the podcast for people who have two modes of operation, either extreme, nearly obsessive preparation, research, thinking it through, acting it out, making it happen, or 100% flying by the seat of your pants, winging it, going entirely extemporaneously, which is what I'm doing at this moment. I'm your host, Ann Smith, with a bonus episode that I have wanted to and also hesitated to record for some time now. It's not an episode that's for everyone, but it is absolutely an episode that I needed at a certain time in my life, and you may need, you may have needed, your friend might need. I am sitting here today, September 27th, which is the 8th anniversary of a due date that I was given in early 2013. I did not have a roadmap when I lost our baby at 4 months along for what life would look like, what this meant, the statistics that 1 in 5 or 1 in 4 pregnancies would end before a baby lands in your arms. It didn't feel real to me. It didn't seem to be anything that people spoke about publicly. It didn't seem appropriate. Even now, I feel like giving you the caveat that, hey, I'm not going to be bawling my way through this episode, as though that would be shameful. I still feel shame around the word miscarriage. I hate it. As a person who places a lot of meaning on language, the word miscarriage has connotations of wrongdoing to me, much like, you know, incompetent cervix or hostile uterus. It isn't kind or necessary. And often you'll hear me say that I lost a baby or we lost a pregnancy. To me, it feels like I lost a baby at that time. And I felt very alone in doing it. One thing I did that I think was a tremendous coping mechanism for me was write about it in the moment. From a psychological, sociological, historical standpoint, I'm really fascinated to read the contemporary writing of a girl who was shell-shocked, sitting up in bed, preparing for surgery, whose world had already been upended by some unthinkable trauma just the year before. I have bottomless wells of compassion for that version of myself, and I wanted to share it with you today because it seemed like the right thing to do. It seemed like some kind of light at the end of the tunnel would have been immensely helpful for me, and some kind of cathartic release of all those feelings, putting them into words, might be able to be conveyed by osmosis through your little earbuds. And also, I would love to shake off the shame of a word you won't really hear me say often in real life. I would love to shake off the silence and the stigma. Even though I was pretty open about it, I still feel hesitant and I still feel nervous to talk about it. And I did nothing wrong. And you've done nothing wrong. And the only thing that makes hard moments worse is feeling you have to keep it to yourself, feeling you're the only one. I tried to record this before and got a bit too in the weeds about what our life looked like at the moment that this happened. We had had two beautiful, healthy babies, and an emergency surgery turned my life upside down. Our two-week-old daughter suddenly had a very uncertain future, an undiagnosed birth defect with a high fatality rate. It was a pretty horrific year. It was the worst thing that had ever happened to me. So I want to share this story with two caveats. One, there's still a lot of joy and hope and numbness in the during and the after. There's a spectrum of emotions. And two, I want to recognize both the privilege I had in being able to get pregnant. If you have not been able to get pregnant, if you've not found the person you want to have a baby with, if you've lost a baby the day you found out there were two lines on a stick, your hurt is no different than mine. I am immensely grateful that my family did not struggle to conceive. We struggled in some other ways, in some ways that mean I don't remember everything for several years of my life. And I'll include a few links if you're interested in the laundry list in the background of what that meant. Really, from 2012 to 2016-17, it was just not even waiting for the other shoe to drop, just constant barrage of just boots falling from the sky. I don't know. So I want to share with you what I wrote then in the hopes that it can help you either as you heal, as you walk someone else through this kind of loss and you don't know what to say or do, or as you just have compassion and curiosity for what other people carry. Because if I've learned anything, I've learned that even the most beautiful, sparkling, pristine, perfect, put together person is carrying or recovering from or wishing for or missing something you just couldn't imagine. And this was a time in my life that I had already stared down the bottomless well of awful and had just barely peaked up for air when another kick came. And if it's helpful for you to hear these words or for you to just lend me support in what feels really terrifying. I'm a woman who speaks and writes for a living, and yet this feels so hard and vulnerable. So my hat's off and my heartiest appreciation for guests who come on and tell their stories every week. And here is a part of mine. I used to have a blog that was called Ann Says So. Some of you might know me from that time period. I think I started it in 2008. The name was a play that one of my dearest friends registered a URL, Ann Says So, with the same initials, essentially, an acronym, whatever you want to call it, of ASS, because theoretically those would be my married initials. You'll probably know from other episodes that they're not, but it's pretty funny nonetheless. So on Ann Says So, I wrote this on April 2nd, 2013, within hours of finding out some news, and this was the first time I had spoken publicly about being pregnant. I titled it A Big Surprise, A Bigger Loss. After last year, my prayer for 2013 was that it would be boring, uneventful, nothing to report. That wasn't to be the case at all, in wonderful and less wonderful ways. As I rounded the corner in my post-race recovery, editor's note, you can tell that I had PTSD and lost my mind because I signed up for a half marathon with a newborn. We'll discuss that at a different time. As I fended off the flu after the race, Bradley and I got a pretty big surprise. Two pink lines. A very unexpected, wholly undeserved blessing. Mary Brooks was only 11 months old at the time. After running the numbers, we realized that our third baby would be born just 8 months later. The day before Mary Brooks turned one, we heard a gorgeous, perfect, super fast heartbeat and confirmed we'd be meeting the third baby Smith in late September. Today, by the way, to be exact. By then, Mac would have been a week or two shy of 4 years old. For a brief moment, we'd have three under four this coming fall. We were overwhelmed, overcome with gratitude, and excited beyond words. It felt like getting away with a bank heist, like winning the lottery. We got something wonderful for nothing. My heart had healed just in time, and we were wide open to the joy a new life would bring. We celebrated Mary Brooksy's first birthday, knowing she'd be a big sister this time next year. We giggled and dreamed and joked. I went back a month ago, at around 12 weeks, to hear that tiny heartbeat again and be assured it was safe to tell the world. A veil of cautious optimism lifted, and it felt safe to set things in stone. There were plans for an SUV, as our sedan couldn't squeeze in another car seat if it tried. There was talk of sharing rooms. A date the week of Mother's Day was circled, and we hoped to confirm baby's gender before then. What an unforeseen gift. This morning, I got a peek at my tiniest baby, just about 4 months along, and saw that she no longer had a heartbeat. Our little bean, our third child, was gone. There will be no baby in September. There will be no SUV for now, no moving Mary Brooks into her big brother's room as he has fervently requested for months. Tomorrow morning, I will go into the hospital for a procedure to do what my body has not yet done itself. I'm sad. I feel guilty for being embarrassed at first about our tremendous blessing and how close our babies would be in age, for putting off telling clients and the whole world, for worrying about insurance and paperwork and the lack of sleep to come. I'd do anything to give this baby a heartbeat back, to fill that empty third car seat in my mind. The moment we found out, 3 months ago, we added a fifth member to our family. We planned names. We envisioned three Smiths growing up. We laughed at how we never saw this coming, the unanticipated joy of a new baby so soon. I never saw this coming either, but I'm thankful all the same. Thankful for the time we had dreaming about this baby and the blessing she was to us. for a life that now turns our hearts heavenward. We know that's where she is. I know there's a plan here, that a God who works miracles, and we and Mary Brooks are living proof, didn't create this child, the one we didn't even think to pray for no reason. We are sad and shocked, but we are held. This morning, amidst the flood of emotions, I was terrified. My heart had just mended. I didn't want to spend another year as a zombie, muddling through a field of heartache and PTSD to get to the other side. The post I had written for today was originally about Joel 2:25, how the Lord had restored my wasted year, how he had healed me, but brought beauty from those ashes. I'll post it another day, and I'll add a new chapter. I know he'll do that again, that we'll be healed, that something glorious will come out of what we're living, out of what feels wretched and aching and awful this minute. I'm asking for peace in the meantime and for your prayers. So I went to bed that night and knew that I was going to the hospital in the morning to have surgery, which I super didn't want. And a little bit later, 2 weeks later, I wrote a post called Goodbye Before Hello. It's been 2 weeks since we lost our third baby, 14 of the fastest days in our marriage. We wish we'd experienced the sensation of time hurtling past us when Mary Brooks was hospitalized, when the future was so terrifying and unclear. Where is the fast forward button when you really need it? I spent that Tuesday, the morning I saw our baby without a heartbeat, alternating between fog and clarity. I held myself together at the doctor and called Bradley from the parking lot, losing myself at the sound of his voice and breaking the news in between sobs. I kept telling him how sorry I was. He thought I believed I'd done something wrong. He wanted me to stop apologizing, but that wasn't it. It really just broke my heart to break that news to him. Bradley, you lost your baby too. I physically doubled over at the pain of hurting my husband that way. I didn't want him to feel what I was feeling. I got home and went straight to bed in crisis mode, propping myself up to text, email, and make all the necessary calls. I felt compelled to spread the news, even to people who'd never known I was pregnant, to respond to loved ones and rest in between as I could. And then I needed to be up, to be busy and out of my usual space. I had no idea what to do with myself. I wasn't pregnant anymore. I left the house to grab lunch, call clients, and speak with a poise that escapes me even when I'm trying my hardest. Thank you, God, for moments when I'm outside of myself. And for their kind, caring, far beyond professional reactions at the news that I'd be out of pocket and why. I called my OB to schedule the surgery, and I was thankful that our favorite doctor was on call to do it. She's yet to deliver one of our children, but at this point an orderly could catch my newborn and I wouldn't care. It's such a happy time. This was something I was both heartbroken about and terrified to have done. I needed her in that OR, and I'm tremendously relieved she was able to take care of me that day. The night before I barely slept, I stared at the clock, swallowing a continuously growing lump in my throat, fighting back the fears of a surgery I never wanted to have. I'd never been under that kind of anesthesia, been intubated, been in a hospital gown except to welcome a perfect crying baby into my arms. The surgery itself was much easier than I anticipated, and the compassion and care we received, especially on a floor where babies were being born that very minute, was unparalleled. Our doctor teared up over us before she took me back. I knew she felt this too. I'm not sure how Bradley managed to stare at the walls for the hour I was gone, but he did. I'd have crawled out of my skin in his shoes. I came home and slept all day Wednesday and most of Thursday, making up for lost time and avoiding the what do I do with myself now thoughts that were pretty much all I could manage when I was awake. The house was too quiet with Mac and Mary Brooks and my parents, so it made my waking hours difficult. But I appreciated the time to focus on me, to sleep and be waited on hand and foot by a man who's been far too good for me since the day we met. We did little but talk and rest that day, skating by on the bare minimum of activities except a mall walk, senior citizen style, to fend off cabin fever Friday. That Saturday, we went to a beautiful wedding out of town that reunited us with friends we hadn't seen in a while. It was a last-minute decision, putting on gold wedges and choosing to dance and sip the night away. I'm really glad we did. As for Bradley, our loss is the same, but we're dealing with it differently, just as we did with what happened to Mary Brooks. This time around, I'm not going to let that make me feel crazy or too emotional or hypersensitive. Bradley stays busy to process things, and I just process them, full time. We're both okay, though, and I wouldn't be standing if he wasn't right beside me. I wouldn't be standing without my faith and my family and the knowledge that I've lived through something agonizing and survived to see the other side. I can do this. The searing pain in Mary Brooks' situation, my euphemism for what we lived through last year, was watching her suffer and scream and hurt, feeling I should do more, do something to help. It felt like dying, watching her hurt. This baby didn't suffer. She was a delight to us from the moment we knew she was coming, even in my sickest moments. I felt thankful all the way through, and I am filled to my brim with joy at that knowledge. This baby has brought me happiness, even though I won't see her sweet face in our nursery. What we're working through is sadness for us, not our child. Our baby is healed, whole, and healthy. God answers the prayers we all have for our babies. Take care of them, keep them safe, make them healthy, let them know they're loved. He's answered each one of those, just not in the way I wanted. I'm at peace with that right now. People ask how I am, and I don't know if anyone really believes I am well as a girl can be in this situation, truly. I haven't cried since the day of the surgery. Editor's note, this is nothing to brag about, which is a small miracle given my overactive tear ducts. My heart is mending. It's focused on the many splendid parts of my life. Working in yoga pants, laughing with my husband, enjoying long overdue spring weather, kissing my newly chubby daughter's cheeks, giggling as Mac tells me I'm the sweetest sweetheart he ever had. My heart is full. I'm trying so hard to be in this moment, in this day, not reliving the blank faces and sad eyes in an ultrasound room, not wondering when our baby stopped growing or if I should have noticed at the time. My heart is with our two children here, soaking up the moments I might have glossed over or even been exhausted by before. It's with the baby I won't meet on this earth. I wonder what our family would have been like with that addition. I cringe opening Mary Brooks' closet door, seeing the dresses I left without monograms, hoping they'd be reused by a baby sister next year. In Bradley's logic, aren't they just as pretty without monograms? Do we have to put her initials on everything? God bless that man. I'm startled by pregnant bellies on Facebook and Instagram, though, by girls who were due when I was or even later. I scroll quickly past those pictures, wishing them well, but knowing it's best for me not to linger on what others have right now. I've been given so much, and I need to count my own blessings. The thing is, other people having babies has nothing to do with my loss. It's wonderful for each family, and we're excited for them. But that spot is a bit raw for me. So I'm giving myself breathing room and avoiding things that cue unnecessary sadness. I'm scrolling past. Happiness and pregnancy, for that matter, it's not a zero-sum game. Someone else having a beautiful experience doesn't take away my opportunity to do so, and boy, am I thankful for that. I'm so giddy for other people's happy news, but I'm in a spot where joy and gratitude mix with deep sadness. That has to earn me some grace. I lost a baby. That's so bizarre to say even now. It feels foreign, surreal, impossible, empty sometimes. I was pregnant, and then I wasn't. How could a life change so much that quickly? But I did lose a baby, and I've got to treat myself with kid gloves if just for a moment. Not opening Brooksy's closet or commenting on gender announcements doesn't hurt anyone, but it might spare me a wince in a delicate time. I've received support and sympathy from our loved ones and from a variety of unexpected sources. The further I get into this, the more I realize I've joined a club no one wants to be a member of, but many are. My experience, though my own, isn't entirely unique. The emptiness isn't unfamiliar to people who've gone before us. I'm both comforted and saddened by that. I want to make everyone's time in this space easier. I've learned to show grace to people who mean well but express it poorly, even using words that hurt or sting or confound. I've learned that there's no sliding scale for grief. If never becoming pregnant is the worst thing that's ever happened to you, your loss is the same as mine. There's no degree of grief that doesn't hurt, and categorizing losses by how far along or how deeply felt does no one any good. If you've ever been here, I am so sorry. I hope you never have to return. I hope none of us ever has to return. I thank you for your prayers, advice, encouragement, and apologize for not having the time to respond. I've devoted myself to recuperating and working my way through this. There's no time left to spare to denial or powering through sadness. I lost 9 months of memories to that last year, and I just can't do it again. So I'm feeling what comes my way now, moment by moment. Mostly I'm feeling loved and ready to get back to normal, whatever that is. But if I have sad spots, I try to feel those too. How new agey am I sounding right now? I sure wish this hadn't happened, or that it had happened far, far sooner than it did. But it did, and I'm here. I'm swimming along, pushing my way through this and hoping I can be the shoulder or ear to someone who joins this unfortunate club one day, should she need me. So many of you have been there for me. It's remarkable, the bond that forms between people who've hurt the same way. Turns out there are no free passes for crappy things, even if you feel you just put one behind you. This world is broken, and this life is not easy, but you've been the Lord's arms and shoulders, and bread and wine and flowers and cookies these last 2 weeks. I'll never be able to repay you. I awoke the day after surgery, believing all this was a bad dream. It isn't, but what I'm waking up to is still beautiful. This is what grief looks like when you stare it in the face. This is a do-over in which I let the Lord in right where I am. I'm sad. I'm thankful. I'm at peace, truly, and in a way I can't explain. It's bittersweet, but I'm not going to fight the grief this time. There's too much wonder here to waste. And then at the bottom of this entry, I include a verse that I've talked about several times on this podcast. One that was shared with me, and it's just something that's hard for me to even speak aloud sometimes and totally get through, but I felt it in my bones. Psalm 27, 13 and 14 say, I would have despaired unless I had believed that I would see the goodness of the Lord in the land of the living. Wait for the Lord. Be strong and let your heart take courage. That idea that I would see his goodness in the land of the living, I didn't super feel like I was in the land of the living at that point. I felt like I was at that moment in Hamilton, and it's quiet uptown, where she says, well, she talks about how the pain is so deep that sometimes it just feels easier to swim down. And while I didn't swim down, I wasn't really trying my best to emerge, despite the big game I was talking. 6 months later, I wrote something called On the Other Side. I was pregnant again with Chapman, and it had already started out pretty traumatically. I started hemorrhaging at 11 weeks and was in and out of the hospital, and he ended up coming 6 weeks early and staying in the NICU, and there were steroid shots and a return visit to the children's hospital with a skull fracture and all kinds of failure to thrive and therapies and diagnoses, and it ended up not being a great time either. But this is what I said 6 months later. I said, there have been so many balls in the air, family, work, pregnancy, staying semi-sane, attempting to keep my children clothed despite their desires to the contrary. But I've been touched and taken aback by the response to our experiences in the last year and a half. People pull me aside at tailgates, by email or Facebook message, and talk to me about transparency in the face of struggle. It's inspired me, loudmouth that I am, to keep talking and to thank each of you who've shared your story with me. Side note, this is exactly why I started the podcast, because I felt that other women should hear what I was able to hear. If you've landed in these words because you love us or you're curious about how we are, I'm happy to give you a peek into our lives. Besides, we're great. How are y'all? If you're reading because you've walked a similar path and want a window into how we're dealing with it, well, here it is. Last Friday, September 27th, was our due date for the baby we lost in April. As it approached and friends who had been expecting alongside us began to deliver, the reality of what was missing felt weightier. When I stay in motion, I can glide through life without processing it. Sometimes that's a valuable skill. There are times, though, when you've got to face facts, and last week was one of those times. Leading up to the due date that wasn't, I felt oddly empty, as if my arms should be holding something, someone. I don't know if it's biology, hormones or the fact that I've never carried a baby past 39 weeks, but my body knew it was time. I was waiting on a baby that wouldn't arrive, and it made my heart ache. Thankfully, as with many things in life, anticipation was worse than reality. The days before, I had flashes of would have been, what would have been, of a happy ending. On the due date itself, I felt peace. I'd certainly never have chosen to lose our baby, but we see the Lord's hand in the way our lives are coming together in the wake of this loss. Bradley and I spent the remainder of the weekend celebrating Clemson's homecoming and eating far too much of his mother's cooking. I tried to focus on all I'm thankful for, our little family, the incredible support we've gotten, the opportunity to help others who are hurting. I can't ignore the fact that unlike many friends of mine who've lost babies, I'm expecting another. It made the day bittersweet, realizing our future Valentine wouldn't be on the way if we hadn't lost our third child. By the way, joke's on you, Anne, because that Valentine is actually going to be a New Year's baby. Ha ha! Knowing I can't control the timing of any of this, the fact that it happened the way it did, it could be paralyzing, but it's actually quite freeing right now. I have no hand in this. I'm along for the ride. I didn't create these lives, I can't control them, and I believe the one who did has a plan far better than my own. Even if there are spots that feel like nothing could be worse, in all honesty. I'm thankful we'll meet our third baby one day, that someone who is a part of us is already in heaven. It brings me great joy to imagine meeting the child we didn't get to hold here. I'd dreamed of late September for months and dreaded it since I saw our still baby on an ultrasound screen. September 27th came and went, and we're still here. We're thankful, hopeful, moving on. We'll never forget this baby. I'll never wish I wasn't holding her, never stop imagining her face. The pain of the due date is behind me, though, even if the whole experience may never quite be. I'm on the other side, and it's not as scary as I imagined. If you're not on the other side, if you're right dab smack in the middle of the not peaceful, not healing, not putting one foot in front of the other, flat out wretched and absolutely not okay part, my heart is with you. These verses were shared by a wise friend who's been there too. Though the fig tree doesn't bud and there are no grapes on the vines, though the olive crop fails and the fields produce no food, though there are no sheep in the pen and no cattle in the stalls, yet I will rejoice in the Lord. I will be joyful in God, my Savior. And in 2021 is not going to lie to you folks. I meant that I would have passed a polygraph. I believed that I meant it. I didn't really feel it all the time. I didn't give myself a lot of latitude to feel grief and resentment and anger because I felt that I had too much to be grateful for. If we took a shot for every time I said thankful in those posts, we would all be in a coma right now. I didn't know how to cap my feelings, how to process them. I was afraid that if I fell into them, I would never come out. And I had just lost so much time to panic attacks and physical and emotional signs of trauma from nearly losing our newborn that this felt like something I needed to surpass. I'm going to read one more, and it's 1 year after our loss. It's called The Laundry List, and little did I know that the laundry list would be extended to include being told our baby would have a 1 in 4 chance of having a chromosomal abnormality that would affect her whole life, being told she was also failing to thrive and needed help and all manner of fun things. But let's just pretend this is where the happy ending starts, okay? Recently, I caught up with a friend I haven't spoken to in a while. It's been a busy year or two for each of us, and I felt a catch in my throat at her simple, "What's been going on?" question. What hasn't gone on? Ardent list maker that I am, the inventory is easy enough to trot out. Number one, had Mary Brooks. Number two, almost lost Mary Brooks. Number three, almost lost my mind. I would argue, by the way, that I definitely did. Number four, finally came back to life 9 months later. Number five, ran the Walt Disney World half marathon for charity and, decidedly unpregnant, rode every roller coaster on the property. Thanked God hourly for the chance to start fresh. Number six, found out I was expecting. Surprise! And sorry for those loop-de-loops, baby. Number seven, lost our baby. 4 months. Had surgery. Stayed in bed for approximately a century. By the way, this is a true story. A significant part of my emotional and physical healing relied on me being in bed probably 20 hours a day. Number 8. Got, as we gallows humor types like to say, re-pregnant. Thought I was losing that baby due to a Law & Order SVU crime scene level middle of the night wake up. Number 9. Hospitalized more than once on sporadic bed rest, alternately terrified and in denial. Number 10. Unexpectedly delivered our son 6 weeks early. Number 11. Endured a 1 week NICU stay. Number 12. Survived a sinus infection, ear infection, mastitis combination. Number 13. Thought that was the worst we'd handle this year. Number 14. Back at the children's hospital with a preemie and his fractured skull. By the way, do you know how hard it is for a preemie to fracture his skull? Really hard. They are quite soft. And if I heard that one time, I heard it 543 times. Not great. I'll tell you that story at a later time. Number 15. Earned ourselves a 3-day vacation right where we fought for Mary Brooks' life 2 years before. Number 16. Nearly re-lost my mind. True story. I actually told a pediatric neurosurgeon, the only one in our part of the state, that I had to go home that night or we were going to need Ativan and a psych consult because I could not possibly stay on that hall where so many horrible things happened. And he gave me a very sympathetic head tilt and said, I hate that. But I sent a baby home like this once in residency and he died. So we're not going to do that. Cool. Cool story, buddy. Thank you. Number 17. Ran out of the hospital and swore we'd burn it down before we set foot there again. Number 18. Came back with a baby who wasn't gaining weight. Yes, my phone actually gave me daily updates at this point about how long it would take me to get to the children's hospital. My phone thought that I worked there or something now. Number 19, fielded daily questions as to why newborn Chapman was insanely small. Y'all, please don't do that to a girl. No one's baby is insanely anything besides cute. Number 20, brought in a team of experts, a pediatrician, lactation consultants, occupational therapists, feeding specialists, a hospital grade scale, and one manic mother. 21, took a deep breath. Began to enjoy what is, in truth, a beautiful and blessed life. And a sweet peanut baby who may just be getting the hang of this weight gain thing. By the way, no, he wasn't. He would be 15 pounds at 1 year old, but that's okay. Amidst all that, we felt called to have Bradley leave his job of 9 years. It was slowly sucking the life out of our family and our marriage. The last thing we needed after Mary Brooks' ordeal. By the way, by that I mean the week that we called it, he worked 95 hours. And that is also a different story for a different day. But it was not a great time. Bradley's quitting was tremendously brave, one that both humbled and scared the pants off of a planer like me. At every point, despite the stresses we encountered, our family has seen confirmation it was the right decision. He started a business and after 18 months of searching for the right job, began a new full-time position just before our preemie was hospitalized with a skull fracture. The pressure, the waiting, the healing, the constant change was heavy and unrelenting. We were refined by fire, and I felt every bit of it burn. There were many nights I wanted to opt out, be passed over, fast forward to the easy part. I began to wonder if anything would ever feel simple and free and fun again. When you write it all out, that laundry list looks like a fair bit. Maybe I've outlined a fabulous memoir in these bullet points. I wonder, as people have often asked, how we did it. In each moment, though, you don't philosophize or quit. You can't. The only option is to push through. You laugh with your husband the morning of your DNC. You shuttle yourself and your milk supply from home to NICU and back again. You remind yourself in the children's hospital that this isn't that, looking at the families with harder struggles. You remind yourself your son isn't fighting for his life, even if you're fighting for your sanity. You thank God for good sleep, sweet babies, and a family who drops everything for you. You wonder if you've gone through this particular whirlwind to carry other people who are fielding harder, even more painful fights. You wish you never knew about any of this and desperately want your white picket fence, never had a panic attack, perfect life back. You want your what's new laundry list to be first movies with your kids, snow days, pigtails, park trips, post-bath snuggles, and birthdays. Your story's partly that, but the heart of the matter is a whole lot more. And when someone asks what you've been up to, you don't know how to tell her you're not the girl you were before. When you hang up, you ask God to use this laundry list of chaos, this hard-fought battle, this big, ugly scar on an otherwise smooth history for a good purpose. What comes after the laundry list? Can it please be finished this season? I'd hate to see Bradley arrested for arson, and I'm pretty sure he's serious about burning down the children's hospital as soon as we evacuate all the babies. These are all stories for another day, I promise. I read this to you to show you that this is one of the last posts I actually had kind of the brain space to write. I wrote about Chapman's premature birth, his NICU stay, but the last real post I wrote is called What If I'm Still Broken? And I'm going to read it to you very quickly because I do have to go because those children grow and I got to go pick them up. But I think that in the 3 years since the start of Mary Brooks's ordeal and the writing of this post, which took place about a month before we found out we were pregnant with our fourth baby, I felt a lot of guilt. I beat myself up and made things twice as bad as they had to be. I said backstory. It's been 3 years. Last week was the second anniversary of the miscarriage of our third baby. Chapman's pregnancy, which mercifully began quickly afterward, was marked by severe unexplained bleeding throughout and capped off with a premature delivery. He had a NICU and separate children's hospital stay, followed by months of anxious efforts to help him grow, something he is only finally doing in the roly-poliest way. Our life is still beautiful, but I brace continually for the next blow. I struggle mightily with the knowledge that I'm still broken, even armed with the passage of time. I don't know how to introduce myself anymore. I used to be simple Anne who went to Clemson, fell in love with her best friend, had a beautiful boy, started a small business, and found humor in her awkward moments. I'm insanely talkative. There were plenty of awkward moments. Then my life got thrown into a blender. We were tossed about in fits and spurts, more violently in some moments than others, and are just now emerging after years of being smacked against the walls. I worry what people need to know about me is that I'm not who I used to be or who you might have known. It's been 3 years since the first of the dropkicks came, but I'm still someone bruised and more delicate than before. What I see now is viewed through a wholly new lens, colored by what flipped us inside out without warning. I imagine you're tired of my incessant talking about it. It scares me. It's what I've learned, what I've come through, who I've become is the most available part of me. C.S. Lewis wrote that part of every misery is, so to speak, the misery's shadow or reflection. The fact that you don't merely suffer, but have to keep on thinking about the fact that you suffer. A season of introspection makes me question whether I'm truly processing or just dwelling on something others would have swept away by now. There's endless room to doubt. From day one, I wanted to legitimize my hurt. This isn't exactly a scheduled appendectomy, I'd tell myself, but we're home now. Why am I not over this? A wise friend first used the word grief to me when Mary Brooks's future was unclear. Grief, I believed, was something for people crying at a graveside. It turns out that's just the clear-cut kind. There are infinite iterations of grief, and it's more than possible to mourn a person who hasn't been buried. I mourned what I had before things got messy, when I trusted life would be good because it always had been, when I had that optical illusion I was captaining my own ship, directing and managing what came into my life. In that long season, I mourned my daughter's health, my happy-go-lucky state of mind, my older son's delicate and broken heart, the baby and innocence we lost, the ability to enjoy pregnancy without debilitating fear, the simple conversations I could have with strangers when my greatest troubles were dusty baseboards, dirty diapers, and whatever sad story played on the evening news. To this day, I struggle with whether what I've felt and what I still carry is legitimate. Do I deserve to be broken? Hasn't enough time passed? Don't I get to be that old girl again? Because people may not tolerate this much longer. How could people believe I've earned this much room to process if they don't even understand what this is? We barely understand it ourselves. How could they give me grace in the meantime if they don't know our story? How can they extend me patient kindness when I can't give it to myself? Do I have to describe the scars and ultrasounds and bleeding and shocking bills and panic and failure to thrive and unseen traumas? If people don't know how the hurt started coming and never stopped, how could they see me as anything but self-indulgent and a bit off my rocker? I imagined walking around in a sandwich board with my laundry list spelled out for all to see. Maybe get a facial tattoo so no one can miss the memo. You need to know who you're dealing with, world, and she's all cracked up. She's not in the thick of things anymore, not wearing her morning clothes or staying up nights with panic attacks, but she may not be normal quite yet. One question has weighed heavily for some time now. What if I'm still broken? Our brains are designed to function in crises. It's fascinating to me how your body keeps moving. Your mind keeps processing things. Not everything, but enough to remain vertical, to put one foot in front of the other when it's necessary. Enough to stay in one piece. It's after the crisis passes that the bottom can fall out. You're left keenly aware of how broken you are, utterly smashed to smithereens. Your trauma wasn't a simple slice to be glued back together. It's a series of rifts, of jagged cuts that reopen unexpectedly. There's nothing straightforward about healing. Even Lewis agrees. I thought I could describe a state, make a map of sorrow. Sorrow, however, turns out to be not a state, but a process. It needs not a map, but a history. Sometimes you're still healing even when good things happen around you. Circumstances change, celebrations are had, babies come home, everyday life resumes. But there's still a guilt and weight behind what appears to be easy joy. How long can you feel duplicitous? Can you wear two faces alternately? When is the expiration date for what you've borne? Is it when every last ounce of the burden is gone? When the bills are paid off, or the stitches dissolved, or the first anniversary is passed? While I'm not the best at living it out, my approach and my advice for others is this. Look at yourself with the eyes you'd cast on a hurting friend. Would you be gentle? Empathetic? Encouraging and understanding if grief pops back up for no reason? How would you speak to her? How many tears would you allow? Why is it so exceedingly difficult to extend the same heartfelt compassion to ourselves? My other approach, besides talking to myself in the non-literal sense when possible, as I would a dear friend, is to accept the ugly with open arms. Look, Simple Anne is gone. Your rage at a long Starbucks drive-thru line is going to be lost on me. I've got bigger fish to fry, and that just isn't one. These days, I'm going to hear surgery, and before you get to the part about 3-minute outpatient procedure to put tubes in my child's ears, I'll be planning meals for 6 months and naming our forthcoming community outreach event. At some point, hopefully this point, I'm going to have to accept that the wreckage of the last few years is my life. There's no getting the old one back. I can be useful here, even as I sort things out. I was called to this place. I am needed and equipped. Maybe exposing my raw edges publicly and coming to terms with them on my own opens me up to be more valuable, more vulnerable, more keenly aware of how I can serve others. Maybe suffering creates for us a new kind of ministry, giving not just of our time or our resources, but of exactly who we are, shattered, taped together, even unrecognizable. And maybe there's no timeline, or bell curve, or fade-out schedule for sadness. What I carry doesn't feel the way it did before I had Chapman in my arms, but it still does feel like something. There are a lot of hard months directly behind me, and that truth doesn't dissipate as soon as the calendar flips. Our hard season was a loss, obviously. It was a series of losses. The baby we lost was a part of me, a piece of all of us, and then she was gone. I had to grieve that. I had to prepare myself for more sadness when it seems Chapman's story might not end happily either. But there's a voice inside me that whispers, you only get to think about this so much before you're wallowing. I don't want to wallow. I want to matter. I want to let the hurt seep out if it needs to and reach out in the knowledge that some of you are hurting too. I know now that these aren't just our lives. This tale doesn't just belong to us. In the simplest sense, I suppose it does, but once things hit the skids, you quickly see you're not the author here, just a player, albeit one who can contribute greatly. It's not a story of you, so much as through you. You don't have to hold back who you've changed into or what you're carrying. The damage you've seen can power your life, your ministry, even if you haven't reached the likely unattainable finish line of wholeness. I'm here to tell you your brokenness doesn't disqualify you from contributing to a greater plan. Today I'm walking alongside a friend whose beautiful son has been fighting hard in a NICU since his birth 5 weeks ago. By the way, he would be in that NICU for 10 more months. He was born with what Mary Brooks had, intestinal malrotation and volvulus. He had 3 emergency surgeries in his first 4 days on Earth. To his mother, I replay the words that propelled me in my longest days. She is as in the trenches as it gets. I am voicing to her what I needed to hear 3 years ago. But I'm keeping some things to myself. The life or death disasters are adrenaline-pumped first chapters, but they aren't where it ends. There's so much work to be done in the quiet afterwards. The afterwards lasts a lot longer, and sometimes it proves your mettle more than the emergency. Though my mettle is counterintuitive, it's throwing my arms open, my head up, and asking to be used, even though I still feel very empty sometimes. I say all of this, every word of this nonfiction novella, both as an encouragement and a 2-parted plea. Keep going and bear with me. Wherever you are, you can be useful. It is my most fervent prayer that I am useful in each step, shaky ones included, out of this hurricane. Lewis said, "The time when there is nothing at all in your soul except to cry for help may be just that time when God can't give it. You are like the drowning man who can't be helped because he clutches and grabs. Perhaps your own reiterated cries deafen you to the voice you hope to hear." Lewis was a perceptive man. I never felt God couldn't help me, but I do now work to ensure that whatever cries I have are punctuated by praise and silence. I want to find my purpose in this, and I can't do that without seeing how far I've been carried. I know I can't do this on my own. I know I want to not just take strength from my community, but add to it. So what if I'm still broken? I just don't know. That part of the story is a mystery. I'm certain I'm damaged goods, but I'm equally confident that's not the only evidence of what's happened here. A powerful story is brewing, just as big as the storm we survived. The same is true for you. Whatever your storm is, hang on and keep moving in the middle of it. You are not a loss to us. You're not wearing us down. You're not using up our grace. You're not testing our patience. No one is writing you off. You're who you were created to be, cracks and all, and no one sees those scars as boldly as you. Unless, of course, you make that sandwich board or face tattoo. I wouldn't blame you, and it sure would make recognizing each other easier. So I'm going to leave it here, and I'm going to tell you that my DMs, my emails, my window in Carline is always open. I feel this anniversary in my body every fall. I feel it, and I don't know a better way to describe that to someone besides to say that first year especially, I felt like the head count was off. I would count 1, 2 children, 1, 2, 1, 2, and feel that I'd forgotten the third at a park or in the car or left the car seat inside. It was a lingering physical piece of me that was gone. Grieving changes you, your brain, your body. I had hives and chronic sinus infections and hair falling out and shakes and panic attacks that felt like actual heart attacks. And all of that was because of sadness and trauma and grief. And even in the words and the years after this, you will hear me focus on usefulness and productivity. And that's great. That's my prerogative. But that you don't have to be useful right now. You are worthy sitting in bed, crying your eyes out, rocking back and forth. I fell into bed in child's pose before I wrote that first blog post the day I saw she had no heartbeat. I rocked back and forth on my heels and forward again in this completely primitive motion. When I woke up in the middle of the night at 11 weeks pregnant with Chapman, I had had no symptoms with the baby we lost, and I woke up in a pool of blood that I will never forget. And I left my body. I rocked back and forth with my hands on either side of my face like something out of a TV show and just said, "No, no, 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 no. This isn't happening. This isn't happening," out loud. I must have looked unhinged. I didn't have to be useful then. You being okay, you healing, you resting, your recuperation, your remembering and grieving, that's useful. You don't have to be productive all the ding-dang time. You don't have to lie if you're more mad than grateful. You don't have to say that there's a purpose if you don't see it yet. You don't have to do anything. And if you have people who are writing you off because they feel you're wallowing, they feel it's taking too much time for their imaginary grief schedule, you can close that door for now. If you need to nap, nap. If you need to cry, cry. If your friend needs a magnum of wine on their front porch and a half dozen cupcakes with thick buttercream icing every third day, be the girl who drops that off. The worst thing I did was force myself into feeling grateful when there was always gratitude at the heart of it. But beating myself up, flagellating myself for any negative emotion. There are still people in the children's hospital. How could you possibly mourn right now? There are families who never get pregnant. And look at this baby. You should be more grateful. There's no room for sadness. All of this is coming from your brain, from an ugly little place that wants you to snap out of it, and there's no snapping. It's no snapping back. There's no jumping forward. You can feel what you feel, and the sooner you stop trying to shove yourself into a cookie cutter Barbie image of what it means to be okay after a loss, the sooner you won't feel a crushing weight. It might always be there. Your September 27th or your April might feel hard. You might feel really stupid talking to a microphone for who knows how many people to hear, wondering if there's any point in saying these words or if it's self-indulgent or when it's time to let it go. Will I be 85 and this day will still feel weird? But beating yourself up about it sure isn't going to help. And if I had had 50 minutes of a conversation to listen to the day that I got that news and I felt unmoored, I was pregnant and then I wasn't. And for a good 20 hours, I was in between pregnant, but not really, and just existing and wondering what life looked like when everything to that point had been about planning for that third car seat. If I could have had some window into peace in the future, it would have been a gift, but also the freedom to know when you still feel it, and you will sometimes. That's normal. I've said this before, but they have found fetal DNA in a mother's body well into her senior years, well beyond her childbearing times, to the end of her life. There is a piece of that baby floating in my bloodstream right now, and it marks me in a way that I won't see, but I love. I get to carry that here on Earth. I wanted a face tattoo or a sandwich board so people would know something awful happened. I didn't get that, but I do get to talk to you. And if you need someone to say, I've been there and you're right, this is the worst, I want to punch a hole in the wall, nothing should suck this badly, I can be that person for you. I want you to know that it does lift, that there is celebrating, that I am still grateful, and I wouldn't press a button and take back the time I got to carry her, even though I lost her. I wouldn't take back this weird guilt about having Chapman, even though I couldn't have him and her at the same time. The numbers just don't crunch. I delivered him 9 months and 3 days after I had surgery to end that pregnancy. He should have stayed where he was longer, but that's a story we'll take up with his disobedient little self as he ages. I appreciate the time to read words that I wrote that I don't even remember writing, because The human brain is a marvelous thing, and it can be separated from our emotions many times. But use your mind for good. Don't let it beat you. Don't let it tell you should. You should feel this. You should be doing that. You shouldn't be talking about this. You should be further along. Feeling what you're feeling and telling people about it is going to do the world a lot of good. It's going to make you the best version of wherever you are. It's going to record it for posterity, and it's going to give other people the freedom to mourn or feel whatever they mourn or feel. And I'm here. I've been there. I hope you never need to talk to me about this. But you can. Okay, now I really do have to go. I love you for listening, and I'm sorry that I sniffled in your ear. Let's talk soon, okay? Bye, guys.